Last Sunday, I talked about the middle way. The middle way described originally as not falling into the extremes of believing in a life of sensual gratification or a life of self-denial as the way to happiness. Shakyamuni said those are both painful and unproductive paths. Now this means don't set up housekeeping there. It doesn't mean avoid sense pleasure, and it doesn't mean avoid self-restraint. We set up housekeeping there when we believe in our own permanence and act on it. When we take things to be truly solid and therefore worthy of accumulating and defending and identifying ourselves by. Those are taking things as permanent and solid in our lives. That means not setting up housekeeping in nihilism or meaninglessness. So it means not endorsing greed or clinging. That's the happens in belief in the permanence and solidity of things, is that we are greedy for more of them to make us more than we are. And the nihilistic side gets expressed in rejection and hatred. You're not. That's defining something as meaningless, as not worthy, as outside. So those are the extremes, but what's the middle way? What's the middle way that's not those extremes? Is it a narrow, tortuous strait? I think I sort of have led people astray a little with my going on about Scylla and Charybdis last week, because the middle way is not a narrow strait. And nor is it in some sense of abandoning sense pleasure as a dull and a dutiful place. It's not a lifetime in Ross's. The middle way is not defined by these extremes. It's not what's left over. The middle way is the way of the center. And we, from our perspective, may call it narrow or wide or calm or stormy, depending on our personal view of the moment. At any one moment, we have a particular view, and sometimes the view from this corner is pretty stormy out there. But it isn't any one or the other of those things, because the middle way, or the way of the center, is not either or. That's why using the way of the center that gets us away from the sort of the middle as something that's halfway between here and there. This halfway between here and there reminds me of a quip by Oscar Wilde. I want to see the importance of being earnest, and before it started, they had kept projecting some of his witticisms on the screen, and one stuck. The one that stuck said, "Some people make others happy wherever they go. Others make them happy whenever they go." So the middle way is not halfway between wherever and whenever or here and there. You know, it's not that kind of thing. The way of the center, if it's what the middle way is the world of endless and complete interdependent arising. The world of where and the world of when and the world of wherever and the world of whenever, always coming and going. So when we speak of the way, whether we call it the middle way or the Buddha way or the way of the center. It's a very rich word, those little Anglo-Saxon words. I think it's Anglo-Saxon, those little bitty words that carry a lot of freight. So the way is the path or the way forward, the way to go, the way you're on. Kind of that's the sense of passage through time. So the way, the middle way of our lives is a passage through time in which we create time by doing, by walking. Time isn't there sort of happening without us. We invented clocks. They didn't invent us, although it sometimes feels like they've turned on us and are inventing our lives. Actually, we create time and we walk, all of us. The people, the mountains, the skunks, the rocks, the tides, walk, move. So we move, we act, we take in and respond. That's the path, the way forward. That's being on the way. And then there's a sense in that we speak of being in the way. And if you hear, listen to the Buddha Dharma, you hear being on the way and you hear being in the way. And they don't mean you're in my way. No. It's you're in the Buddha way. That's a sense of space. And of course, all of this is a little arbitrary. As soon as we start using words, we're taking particular perspective to look at something. And then at some point, we have to throw those away. We say, this sense of a way forward, we're making our way through life in a sense of time and activity. We're living in the way, in a kind of world or space. Well, maybe they'll make sense and maybe they won't if they don't, just throw them away. No hard feelings. No one set of words carries enough. Is complete. But anyway, those are the ones that are interesting me today. So I was thinking of the way when I speak of the way of the center, I was thinking about the world we inhabit, the space we experience ourselves as in, a sense of place, a sense of being. Sense of being involves some sense of place or terrain or where you stand, whatever you is. And that's the aspect of the way that I'm looking at here. So then the question comes up, what is your world? What kind of world do you live in? And Shakyamuni said one aspect of that is to look at the extremes, where it's not profitable to dwell. The extremes of permanence or meaninglessness. But if you exclude the extremes, you say, oh, okay, I can see that's not a good idea. I will exclude those. Then you find that paradoxically you're living in terms of them. Now, every alcoholic who stops drinking knows that at least for a very long time, maybe forever, depending on them, they will be living in terms of what they have had to exclude. Now, they've chosen to exclude something harmful, but they're not free of it. There's a being in, not defined by it anymore, but in relationship to it, moved by it. So in this same way, if you exclude the extremes, if you turn your back on them, that doesn't mean they go away. That doesn't mean, in fact, you're more in relation to them. You're being determining yourself by them. Your energy goes there, or to fortifying your walls, or into apprehension. Oh, I don't want to go there. I don't want to be like that. And so then the apprehension of where I might wind up comes up. Then they loom and shrink the middle. You get a lot of fundamentalism is one of the forms of that happening, where there's such firm, strong, clear sense of what must be excluded, what is defined as extreme and must be excluded, and those become overwhelming definitions of what becomes increasingly narrow middle. And on the other hand, I was driving. I drive a lot on Bennett Valley Road, where it goes further out, where it's on the way. We're overheading over towards Glen Ellen. and it's narrow and windy and winds around hills and winds around hills. It's quite a narrow road. I mean, as I say, it's two little lanes, but there's no shoulder at all. And there's a ditch on each side. And I go there a lot, and I've never seen a car in the ditch. A lot of people driving fast, a lot of people driving slow, driving around. I've never seen a car in the ditch. Now I started to wonder why I don't land in the ditch. And I land in plenty of ditches. Why not that one? Because there are these really nice hedgerows and trees on both sides, just past the ditch. Right on the other side of the ditch, the world rises up green and season, brown in season, with hedgerows and tall stuff there. And my body and mind just naturally orient in terms of those hedgerows. And it's a little like your buoys that you talk about. So when we let ourselves be naturally informed, and we're including, the ditches are part of my world, otherwise I wouldn't get the hedgerow. I'd have to, if the ditches were the extreme to be excluded, I'd have to be paying a lot of attention to them, and I imagine I would probably in the end somehow drift into them. You know, if you try not to say the wrong thing to someone, you tend to say it, you know, because it's there in your mind. But when they're part of my world, and so is what's these wonderful little hedgerows, then there's a natural relationship, and I can be right here. So far, it's worked. It's part of that kind of being in the moment that we find Zen teacher Shohaku Okamura talks about when he talks about zazen as a time of a condition of being. Very much aware. I said, what kind of awareness? What kind of concentration? No particular object, not a narrow focused one, wide like driving when you're alert. When you're driving and you're alert, your mind is allowing in and attending to many different kinds of stimuli, many different kinds of perceptions, including ones you don't expect. Once I drove around a country road, not here, back east, a winding backcountry road. I took it fairly often. It was kind of a backcountry through road. A lot of people took it, and so you just got driving along, and the next thing I saw was a little creature in his diaper and nothing else standing in the middle of the road looking at me. And I came to a stop in time. And his babysitter came out and screamed at him. But you have to see what you don't expect to see and be able to respond to that. So you have this wide view. If you just look at the yellow line or you just think about the steering wheel, you're gonna miss something else like the pedestrian. So this wide view allows you to take in the ditches and the hedgerows and the car in front of you and hopefully the bird, the squirrel scampering across the road. Last week, Janai said something that was very much to this point. It was the end. That was what got me thinking. And we were talking about whether the center is narrow or spacious or wide. And she said, if you include the extremes, I think she said bookends, but anyway, that's how I took it. If you include the extremes as bookends, the center is vast. You have a big playing field. But that has to be a big, vast playing field in which they are part of it. They're not excluded. Without bookends and markers and hedgerows, we would lack boundaries and thus shape and a sense of and direction, which is one of the aspects of the way, is a sense of direction. But boundaries are naturally, I think, pliable and soft. So when they become rigid, they become brittle, and whenever we have a rigid and brittle boundary, we can't take in nourishment. We starve inside there. But if we become too fluid, we don't know who we are. So what kind of way do we walk on and in? What kind of world or center or space is this? And since it started middle way originally being described in terms of the extremes to avoid, I started thinking about margins. Because we certainly don't want to exclude the margins. We can't, and it's not profitable. Now, Shakyamuni, his litmus test wasn't that there's some absolute reason why you must not do this or must do this. He said, don't fall into living in terms of things that are painful and unprofitable. The margins are sometimes painful, but they're not unprofitable. Because the margins are not about extremes as such, they're about difference. The margin is where something is different, or there's a different rate of change. Knowing margins, because margins take place all they're not only on the outside edge. Every river, the flow of the river, and with endless images of the flow of the way as the flow of a river, the margins where there are eddies are particularly rich and fecund because there's different kinds of turbulence, different quality to the water. They're certainly part of the river, and every canoeist seeks them out. You need them. You can't canoe well in the river. You'll get tired if you don't have eddies to turn into. They're part of the picture. And they inform the whole. And they're also a lot of fun. And viewing your world from a margin where there's different rate of change or what feels like an edge can bring insight, which is, again, one of the differences between something that's profitable and something that isn't. We're not making absolutes here. If it is liable to be a place or condition for insight, that's a positive form of margin. If it clouds the mind, that's an extreme. That's unprofitable. And just this week, I was reading that book I lent you. It's a book by Norman Fisher. And in it, he writes just very briefly, as his mind is wandering very quickly on many topics. He says something about the Jew as eternally marginal. He says, the Jew as eternally marginal gives a sense of mission, because the margin can imagine a better day, can strive for inclusion, and therefore the reformation that permits a universal inclusion. Now, there are many margins. Some we inhabit. All of us experience ourselves in some ways as on the margins, sometimes profitably, sometimes not. When we feel we're on a margin, but in virtue of being excluded from where we feel we would rather belong, that's not profitable. But to be on the margin, sort of on an edge, some of the time and in some ways, can be extremely valuable. It's not helpful to be defined by someone else as the margin. So we all live both where we experience as in the center and where we experience as on the margins. And all of this is in the way of the center. All of this is ways of living in different, quieter and more turbulent places where our subjective experience is different, but where there is insight into where we are and how we walk and how we live. Margins are rich with life. And, you know, the human mind is so designed to perceive difference, to our everlasting joy and horror. We see black and white. We see dark and light. We see motion and stillness. The mind perceives difference. It seems to be, essentially, if we're hardwired for something, is that's one of the important ways we perceive. Edges, difference, color, motion, not motion, nearer, further. And then we weave some kind of pattern of sense or meaning out of these differences we see. So we're going to be seeing and calling things differences. And then we're going to be making up stories, narratives, meanings around this. And of course, we all have a tendency to first, on one hand, say, to turn this into right and wrong, to turn this into what's to be included and what's to be excluded. But at the same time, which also a natural function of the mind, it's the way it works, and to see difference as the margin is the place of difference, where you have things, different rates of change. You see more when we see something freshly. So we're always living in the center, and we're always living on the margin. And one of the ways I see that is that what if you understand each of us, Joko's the center, Holly's the center, Richard's the center of a world, and I'm on the somewhere near, not quite out at the margins of Joko's world, but I'm not right in there in his, I'm not wearing his robes. I'm not going home to Katari this afternoon, so I'm here, but it's close. And so we're not just the furniture, the landscape of each other's lives. So I'm part of, if he's the center of his world, I'm part of it in varying degrees. And for someone I don't know so well, I'm much further out near the edge of what where you are the center. So all of us are the center, and all of us are the margins of each other's world, and we experience ourselves as the margin often of another person's world. So the way of the center is not exclusive in this way, that we are always the center and the margin for ourselves and for each other. Or my world is a center. I am the center of a little world that has no actual edges. It doesn't stop somewhere. The center is always moving. The difficulty with a phrase like the way of the center is that it implies, almost by the language, that there's an inside and an outside. And so the only good way to take a phrase like that is to remember that this is a world of inclusion. Nothing is outside. The margins, those extremes that are not to be lived in, are part of our life. It's just not the place to live. You know, don't set up housekeeping there, but we all go there. Every time we hit even a moment, let alone a longer period of despair, we're on that extreme of nihilism, or the time when we decide to take some extreme course of action, to wrench ourselves back from something. We do that in a form of that sort of self-mortification. Or we all, of course, and sometimes we know it more easily, fall into the extreme of greed and clinging. But seeing it as part of our world, but as an extreme not to live in, allows us to know that there's going there and leaving it again. If it's not part of our world, then we don't know how to leave it again. We only know how to go there. We're more likely to get lost there. So everything is included. If you're in a world of inclusion, if you say, I want to understand myself as living in a world that includes all, how do you discern? And what is restraint? And where would you practice restraint if everything is included? If nothing is going to be exiled? What would be the basis for not only then restraint or refusal, but choice? And that really is one of the beauties of the middle way, is that it's not about absolutes or absolute philosophical statements. It says, when we see, when we do not turn our backs on greed and hatred, simple names for those two extremes, when we don't turn our backs on the twin poles of self-indulgence and self-denial, then we get really good directions about living well, about living a good life. And part of what we learn about is from those two extremes. We see where they are painful, If we try to exclude them, we won't be able to include what we learn about how painful those extremes are. The Buddha way says that don't make an absolute out of restraint either, because that's when we go the way of saying, oh, then life will be kind of dull and narrow if I'm living in restraint or in moderation as some kind of an absolute. It's not an absolute. Restraint from doing harm to yourself or others is what we're talking about in the Buddha way. And then we have to explore what does harm to myself and what does harm to others. Restraint from doing harm to yourself and others opens the way to a very wide life. And that's why the way of the center is this vast field with the extremes as bookends. So just as I say, well, the middle way is practical. It says, what is restraint? Is it an absolute? No, it's restraint from harm to yourself and others, and see if that isn't productive. So thinking in terms of a world of inclusion, see if that's productive for you or not. It's productive if it leads to a way of understanding our not turning away from, not turning our backs, of understanding that we're in relationship to all others. If it contributes to that, to acting on that, it's productive. It's not the most useful term for you when you put it gently down and find another. So many ways to put it. I was looking at a friend's website yesterday. I think it was while I was, I work on a talk, and I said, oh God, I go find someplace else to go do something different for a while. So I went to a friend's website who writes, among other things, and found a little passage by him. And he said, he's not a Buddhist. The middle path of the heart, he said, perked right up. Here I am in the middle of this, The middle path of the heart lies in neither avoiding nor indulging the experiences of life. It's not that he hasn't read some Buddhism, obviously, but you don't have to have. Buddhism is one way of expressing universal truths. It's basically one language. And we say Buddhism is worthwhile if it is a productive language for understanding universal truths and living in terms of them, how to live your life. That's why it's always practical, because behind and under and after, before and after, all the ideas or the philosophical terms or the sort of theoretical expressions are, can you use this to, does it guide you to insight and understanding and compassion and generosity to living a good life? Does it help you decide what you want to mean by living a good life? So, he said, the middle path of the heart lies in neither avoiding nor indulging the experiences of life, but in simply being courageously present, willing to take part in addressing what more we may learn of ourselves in learning about life. Neither overwhelmed nor controlling, neither invading nor abandoning, but simply residing here and now at the center of all infinity and eternity. Maybe that's why we're friends. It's so similar language. He wrote this sometime before we became friends, some years back. So when we neither avoid nor indulge the experiences of life, but take part and learn and exchange. He's called this being courageously present. I like that. Residing here and now, at the center of all of infinity, the center of eternity, the center of the universe, the center of inclusion, but not me the center. This everywhere is the center. And provisionally, of course, I experience myself as the center. And I have to know that that's provisional and that I will experience that and that there's some use to that. I am the center of my actions and my thoughts, of the pattern that's going to have a certain effect on other people and be affected by other people. So in that sense, it's very productive. But as soon as I solidify it, then I get into trouble. In the world of inclusion, the center is everywhere. You're a center. The gray squirrel is a center. The oak is a center of the universe. And so then, I said before, you are the center, including all the others. And what are we going to do about that? And they're the center, including or excluding you. You're the center, including all others. Please take good care of them. And take good care of them for their own sweet sake and for your own, because once they're in your universe, they're who you are. That's part of your world. It's part of you. How they are treated is your world, your life, your experience. They're not just out there. When you have an exclusive universe, when you live in the center of the way of a universe, everything is included. Everything is connected to you. In fact, everything is your world. So how I relate to Holly is both trying to take good care of Holly, to remember that there's a Holly, and she's sort of like me, and she's out there, and take care of her as Holly, and also taking care of Holly as being me. That's how I am me. So the quality of my life is, and the quality of her life, are both affected by how is she the guest in my life, the guest in my universe. And I'm the guest in hers. How am I going to be as a guest? See, because that where I'm the host and you're the guest in my world, well, what kind of guest are you going to be? For your sake and for my sake. And when I'm the guest in your world, how will I be the guest? So how are we the host and how are we the guest? Actually, this host and guest, you know, that one is a very old Zen way of early days of Chinese Huayan philosophy, 1500 years ago. That was one of the images that came up for trying to describe our relationship to each other. That was a school that very much influenced Zen in China and spoke of our being, everything being interpenetrated, everything made of everything else. And one of the ways to make sense of that that I found very helpful is that we are each always the host, hosting this moment, hosting the universe, hosting ourselves, hosting each other, and we are each always guests. The guest of each other, the guest of the universe. What kind of guest are we? Our whole life is as a guest. We're gonna leave the stage and leave a little offering at the end of our pile of ashes. You know, what kind of guest are we? And what kind of host? So in my thinking about this way of the center and the center of the way, which you can take it either way, the host and guest thing again, I thought in this direction, I thought in that direction, I thought in another direction, I had this image and that one, and I didn't particularly weave them together as much as I sometimes do. And I felt as though I was sending out feelers in various directions. I said, well, that's where we got to. That's where I got to with it. And so I can hope that some part of it, some phrase or some aspect of it is relevant to you. And I want to turn it back to you now and ask, what do you think about this center of the way, or way of the center? Is it useful? Is it productive? What way?